IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello everyone and welcome to All Things Policy. Thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Silicon Politics. This will be primarily a short one compared to our previous episodes. Joining me today is Rijesh Panikar, a fellow colleague and also part of the high-tech geopolitics program at Takshashila. Today we will be discussing primarily the newest chip announcements coming from China. Well, they're not really new. They came out in December 2023. But recently Financial Times got a hold of the document that came out in December last year and finally reported on it. And now we have some new details. The two things that happened is that the Chinese Ministry of Industry and Information Technology and the Finance Ministry, they basically came out with some procurement guidelines, which basically are local procurement mandates, listing 18 officially approved CPUs by China's Information Security and Evaluation Center. Now, none of these 18 CPUs were Western-made or designed. So AMD and Intel CPUs, essentially, the ones that are de facto the standard right now, everywhere in the world, right, not just China, they are essentially being phased out. And we'll see a gradual replacement with homegrown alternatives. The other thing that came out is in December as well, and it was announced before globally as well, is that Zhaoxin, which is one of the companies that made a homegrown alternative to an x86 CPU like Intel's. It was a KX7000 series CPU. And we finally have some leaked Geekbench numbers which might suggest their performance benchmarks at the moment. So these two interesting things happened. But the broader context in the question in which we're answering this is essentially, has the US sanctions on China's chip-making industry or its sector failed to some degree that we are seeing these announcements or these, developments keep happening where Chinese homegrown alternatives seem to have matured enough to be deemed fit for use in general purpose computing for governance and public institutions, right? So, Rijesh, just starting off, what's your take on the broader question, right? Do you think these announcements or the developments are indicative of a shift in China's chip making capabilities?
Well, yes and no. I think, you know, just stepping back one step behind and asking the question, has the US's sanctions worked? Obviously, they're having some impact, right? Because that's exactly why China is doing this. And as you pointed out, right, the fact that they feel confident about saying, now we want you to mandate buying these local chips, means there is at least some level of confidence that these chips are good enough. Whether they are on par with their Western chips, probably, I mean, most definitely not. We know that, you know, it's not an easy game in the semiconductor space. You can't just replace one with the other. You need to catch up. But clearly, somebody feels confident enough that these are good enough to replace, at least in like your state-owned enterprises for general computing purposes, which is why they've gone ahead and said, look, we need you to start sourcing from local chip makers. And also, additionally, then the other interesting thing is it's not just on the hardware side, right? They're also trying to do the same thing on the software side, where they've asked people to try and eliminate the Windows OS from their systems and try and use locally built database software. So it seems like an entire sort of theme that's playing out where they're saying we want technological self-sufficiency in all of these things. We want to be independent of all Western manufacturers. Whether it works or not, we'll only find out, I think, in a few years' time, right? It'll be interesting to get your hands on a Chinese laptop that has a non-US built chip and see exactly what it does, I suppose. Until that time, I don't know if it'll be good or not. So,
I mean, we could have gotten our hands on a Chinese laptop if AliExpress didn't stop shipping to India after
exactly.
Prohibitions. But that's a different thing. But yeah, so what you mentioned is also interesting because there were two broad strategies and policies that the Chinese government came up in 2015 and in 2019. And I tried to do some research way back last year trying to figure out what had happened of it. Is the Made in China 2025 strategy, which was basically China's push or the attempt at predicting or charting a pathway where they will move away from the current competitive advantage, right? Which is low-cost labor, low-capital-intensive manufacturing, cheap goods kind of strategy, right? To more high-tech products and services where technology-intensive production processes will take the forefront, alongside a focus on reducing dependence on foreign suppliers, right, in terms of materials, equipment, etc., or even like the firmware or software that goes into this high-tech products and services. So that had come out in 2015, but by 2018, after some backlash from international communities about this being protectionist move or whatever, they had begun clamping down on the rhetoric a little bit, in the sense that they won't mention Make in China 2025 strategy as a driving force behind any local sourcing mandate or like home, like basically pushing homegrown alternatives or domestic industrial policy, right? So that's one. And the thing is, semiconductors were a major part of that. Semiconductors were very explicitly an essential cog in the strategy, but it's also one of the sectors that has been hit hardest by US sanctions, right? The other thing was the 352 policy.
Yeah.
So the first we heard of it is in 2018. It came out in 2019, which is a directive that aimed to remove foreign hardware and software dependencies in government and public offices. So at a rate of 30% by 2020, 50% by 2021, and the remaining 20% by 2022, right? That hasn't, definitely hasn't happened, because we know that for a fact. But the thing is, the fact that this directive came out in 2023, like you mentioned, is it's either someone in the government was of the opinion that they have matured enough in terms of homegrown hardware and software alternatives, which can replace Intel AMD processors as well as operating systems and database software. So maybe we're finally beginning to see the fruition of the 352 strategy. I can't tell. But I mean, yeah, it's also very too early to be able to assess the outcomes of the US sanctions on things like these, because questions about yields of these processors or how competitive they are in terms of performance or even their economies, right? It's very unfeasible. So Pranay, who's, I mean, our colleague Pranay, his takeaway from this is exactly the opposite of what a lot of people are talking about, in the sense that Chinese chip making capabilities are potentially closing the gap with those in the West. But his takeaway is the exact opposite, which is that China is trying to use industrial policy and subsidies to uphold an inefficient local semiconductor industry, right? And which is why, because they need to recoup that investment, they are now going to the local sourcing mandates on this.
I mean, I have a lot of sympathy with that view, with Pranay's view. I think he's right. Like, you know, if as he points out in his post, right, in his newsletter, that if your chips were good enough, you wouldn't need to set up a mandate. People would automatically choose that over an external chip. But that said, you know, I think you also pointed out in other conversations we've had that, look, they may not have caught up, but, you know, they have covered a lot of gap to AMD and Intel's technology. I think you were saying that 5 or 10 years worth of performance they managed to catch up in 2 or 3 years' time. So it's not as though they haven't covered the distance. Maybe they're not right at the edge of it. And perhaps that's not needed either, you know, to do. If you're talking about replacing chips in our desktop, maybe you don't really need to be at the cutting edge. And maybe that's the reason why they think they can push these mandates. And as far as the sourcing mandates go, maybe that's just a function of how China operates in some sense. So who's to say that's not? They might have come up with a sourcing mandate even if they had chips that were at the cutting edge, right? How do we know they would not have? Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, we are not even talking about things like GPUs or AI specific, where it's on inference or training hardware. Those are a very different breed of chips, and it's very difficult to make them in the first place. And China obviously hasn't matured enough in that ecosystem. But okay, I'll just quote from the FT reportage and from what we know about the KX7000 series, which is, we'll take that as the indicative benchmark for this 18 CPUs, right? Zhaoxin KX7000, they have up to 8 cores and they have very decent I.O. from what I can see. They have DDR5 support, they have 24 lanes of PCIe 4.0 and USB 4 support as well. And the thing is, they're also part of the USB consortium, which means that for general purpose computing and even for like maintaining governance service, etc., this is not a far cry. It's not a problem for them, because even if they have an older version of the x86 license, I don't think you need the other extensions for Intel and AMD, for instance, AVX5.2, etc., to be able to, you know, run like Windows 10, 11, or whatever the equivalent of Chinese operating system they have, and it's doing basic stuff. Even like for entertainment or home consumer market, this wouldn't be a problem. Right. So, and the thing is, the previous generation KX6000 was apparently at the same level of performance as Intel's Sandy Bridge, which came out in 2010, 2011. kind of performance benchmark at the time. So at least in single go performance. So the fact that they have bridged around 7 to 8 years worth of architectural improvements in the span of, let's say, 2 years or so, there's something to be said about that, right? Of course, it doesn't have to be competitive for it to be able to function. And that is my primary thing, which is we have to take a closer look at how these companies are coming up with these products. Because finally, and this is the most important part, the KX7000 is apparently using a chiplet design. And that is something which is very difficult to do at the moment. So for the people listening in, chiplet design is essentially just a tiny integrated circuit, right? So it's a smaller integrated circuit, which has a very specific, let's say, purpose for it. So you have a memory chiplet or a logic chiplet, the one that actually does all the calculations and all the takes care of the workloads, or you have the I/O chiplet, which manages the input-output devices, your graphics, interconnects, etc. like that. So the reason why chiplets are becoming more and more essential in the cutting edge of semiconductor technology is because Moore's law is apparently slowing down, right? So we can't keep shrinking production nodes. We can't keep going down from 3 nanometers to 2 nanometers to 18 angstrom and all of that, because at some point, physics is going to take over and then you'll have issues with shrinking nodes. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Maybe we'll go down that lane in a different podcast explaining why, what the problems that exist in this specific aspect. But the reason why chiplets are gaining traction is now you can, instead of having a single silicon die, which has to take care of every single aspect, the I/O, the logic, the memory, all of that stuff, you can now have different smaller chiplets which handle specific workloads or specific functions, and they don't necessarily all have to be of the same cutting edge production node, right? You can have your logic die be the most advanced, it's a 3nm, 5nm or something, or the memory die, which can, the I/O die can be produced on, let's say, 7nm or so. You are cutting your costs down by producing on older, more mature nodes, and B, what you're essentially doing is you're basically taking a Lego-like approach where the sum of the parts is maybe like better than the whole, right? And that's where I wanted to come in is, can you just explain why it's so much more difficult to create and implement chiplet designs these days?
Unfortunately, I can't really answer that because I don't really know that much about chiplet design. But anyway, but I actually had a separate question from that. I mean, I think we should dive into that when we both learned a little bit more about it. But I had a separate question. It just occurred to me that if, in fact, chiplet design becomes the way most people build computers in the future, right? It's very likely that you'll start to see specialization even in that area where, you know, somebody specializes on, say, memory chiplets, I/O chiplets. Now, if the Chinese are trying to break away from the rest of the world, then couldn't they end up being in a place where they have to recreate this entire chiplet ecosystem all by themselves? Because, you know, I could squeeze them by saying, no, you can't get the best I/O chiplets, or you can't get the best memory chiplets. So the same thing that's now happening to them in microprocessors will end up happening to them in all these subsystems as well, if actually it turns out that that's where everybody goes and there's a huge amount of specialization, right? So it seems like a losing game, to be honest, for China, unless they manage to figure out a way to keep up with standards elsewhere or find some way around it.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? So China doesn't really have recourse to a lot of foundries if sanctions keep hitting them, right? If they keep announcing new chip breakthroughs in terms of design at the very least, the US and its allies are going to keep hitting them with sanctions so that other foundries, even those not at the leading edge elsewhere in the world, will not be able to make chips, the smaller chiplets, or even the interconnect for the devices for China.
Well, unless you're able to convince people that, you know, chiplet design and the chiplet interconnection standards should be open and they are able to build an ecosystem of suppliers around the world who are in line with them, right?
Chiplet interconnection already is
an open standard.
Yeah, it's the Universal Chiplet Interconnect Express is already an open source consortium, and a lot of the major chip designers, chip manufacturers, microcontrollers, packaging and then assembly and firms are already on board, right? So in that case, the moment you make it open, so that's fine. But, you know, so that's the thing, right? So advanced packaging and assembly techniques are going to be essential to leverage chiplet design. And this is where there has been a merging of the fabrication segment of the supply chain and the
packaging
segment, right? And here you can't really build expertise, even if you know that in theory what should be happening, right? And that's also been a problem elsewhere in the world, is that when you do embark on cutting-edge technology like this, you need to be able to build this consistently and build on the existing knowledge for quite some time before you have mature enough processes that can actually create functional chip or competitive chip. And as far as I know, China's SMIC is the only one, is the Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, SMIC, is the only foundry that can potentially do this at the moment. As far as I know, there isn't any other foundry within China that can do it. So you're probably going to see, if they are the ones who are finally making 1,000 CPUs, we're probably going to see additional sanctions hit them. I don't know what this means in terms of prohibiting Chinese companies from participating in the consortium like the UCIe consortium. We'll have to wait and see how the sanctions look like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that will be that much different than, you know, attempts at controlling the RISC-V consortium and, you know, how do you consider participation in that. So it will be the same set of games. But another interesting thought that occurred to me is, you know, you were saying, right, that China doesn't necessarily need the latest extension from AMD and Intel if they divert to making their own chips, and they can still be reasonably reasonably capable chips. That's true, but the longer that goes on, right, the more a Chinese designed and built chip diverges from the latest extensions in AMD and Intel, it places a technical debt on their software, because open source Linux distributions will be standardized with AMD Intel extensions. They'll write drivers that maximizes the latest stuff coming out of AMD Intel ARM, let's say, right? So if China keeps building its own chips and there is a divergence in terms of the technical capabilities or how it's built, then again, the Chinese ecosystem will have to build their own software drivers that cope or that can maximize the... So once again, today they are able to, you know, take, say, open source Linux distributions, say we have our own software and you should shift to that. But the ability to do that also diminishes over time if their hardware diverges down different paths. So that's another interesting thing that you have to consider, that, you know, there has to be some level of harmonization with what's going on in the rest of the world, right?
But how difficult would it be for, even if we assume the divergence happens and they end up with a different hardware and software ecosystem at the end of the day, how difficult would it be in the short term, at least 3 to 5 years kind of thing, for them to just create an entirely different Linux and firmware driver ecosystem for their hardware?
No, they could. But the major advantage of Linux is the sheer number of people around the world that are looking at it, working at it, and all of that. Right? You have to replace that entire thing with your own ecosystem. There is a cost to it, both in terms of time at least. And inevitably, it will not be as secure as something built where people all over the world are looking at. Maybe. I don't know. That's just a guess. But at the very least, there's a cost imposed. The cost is not just on the hardware side that you have to replace all the chips. The cost will eventually show up on the software side, because you'll keep accruing debt. And that is interesting. In the long term, it might be interesting to see what happens there, actually.
Well, we are talking about x86 here. Do you see that happening in context of RISC and ARM-based ecosystems as well?
In the context of RISC, no. It's a completely open source specification and consortium. As long as that stays open source, you will find the Linux distributions where drivers are written for that. Now, again, I mean, if let's say for some reason China is locked out of that consortium, although I don't see how that happens. Let's say they're locked out and they have a point in time RISC-V specification. So, and then they take that and run with it, and that again diverges. The moment it diverges, then, you know, unless they have a certain critical mass, why would I, sitting in India or sitting in Finland, write a driver for that thing? I don't have any incentive for it. I can't use it. So why would I write? Somebody in China has to be interested enough to write that. You'll have to build that ecosystem, build the incentives for someone to do it. That's the problem.
So I think we're going to see Chinese government functional agents reach out to open source community, contributors to write firmware and drivers for them, maybe?
Maybe, I don't know.
For the next few years?
Why not?
I mean, that we should probably take a deep dive on the XZ software backdoor happened last week, probably. And in that context, it makes a lot more sense that, you know, China may perhaps government functionaries can infiltrate either software supply chains or get them to do
something. Yeah, I think it's one thing to infiltrate somebody else's open source project software, but it's quite another thing to convince them that they should write, say, drivers for your hardware. Right? You have to give them the appropriate incentives. Otherwise, it's a different ballgame, I think. But anyway, it'll be, it's just something that occurred to me. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, so do you think focus on x86 homegrown alternatives is a stopgap measure between mature Chinese RISC-V alternatives that can then pick up from where this CPUs are left off?
I mean, logically, yeah, I think that's what it should be, because staying on x86 has no value for the Chinese, right? I mean, you're definitely locked out of that ecosystem in the long run. You have no idea where it's going, and it's very tough for you to... The barriers are higher for you to get access to the latest developments there. Whereas RISC-V is open, you are part of the consortium. As far as I can tell today, they're not locked out of it. There doesn't seem to be any simple way at least to lock them out of it. So why would you not invest in that? Yes, I think if the RISC-V standards improve to a place where they are competitive with other architectures, I think that's good for the Chinese, right? So they should definitely, they will, I think, be looking to push that forward.
Right. So, so let's just take a step back and contextualize these developments with what we know happened in the last year. The last year, the Huawei Mate 60 Pro, if I'm not wrong, that smartphone came out with an ostensibly 7-nanometer chip called the Kirin 9000S, the SoC. And that was hailed as an example of how SMIC has, you know, managed to be resilient in the face of US sanctions and still produce a chip at just like a, at that time, just a generation and a half or so behind the leading edge chips that are made elsewhere, but TSMC or Samsung, right? But the issue at that point was we did not know whether yields were competitive. We did not know how much it was subsidized or the defect rate, etc. So, and recently, and last week itself, coincidentally, Huawei and SMIC filed patents for a lithography technique called self-aligned quadruple patterning, and SAQP. Now, SAQP was actually trialed by Intel in, I think, around 2016 to 2020 or so, when they were at their lowest in terms of competitiveness compared with AMD. And the issue was that Intel trialed this because they wanted an alternative to extreme ultraviolet lithography, which ASML currently has a monopoly in, but their yield rates and defects were, and power and thermal envelopes were just not up to the mark using this technology, right? So they ended up ditching this in favor of ASML's EUV tech, or lithography tech. But because Huawei and SMIC don't really have any option or alternative, they have to go down this path, right? So this path is how they aim to produce advanced chips on sub 10 nanometer nodes. And this is what I think gives primary credence to the theory that even if Huawei and SMIC manage to produce decent x86 CPUs using this, like they'll still maybe be competitive in terms of performance or something, but the cost per chip will just render them commercially unfeasible. So we will probably see continued and possibly more aggressive local sourcing mandates. But yeah, so that's all the time we have for today. So thank you, Rijesh, for joining me today. And to all our listeners, thank you, and stay tuned for the next episode of All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.